Could you just start by introducing yourselves and telling us a little bit about you, please?
So, I'm Gavin. I was born and raised in St. Genneth. Lived here for 25 years before I moved to Caerphilly. I helped to set up the drop-in centre and establish the drop-in centre with Michelle and Michael and a few other people. And it's great that it's still here today.
Yeah, my name is Mike Lazenby, Docky as I was known when I was younger. Just like Gavin, I've been pretty much involved in the Abba Valley for all of my life. I'm still a resident here, living in Arbitrido. And just like Gavin as well, I was involved in the setup, startup of the drop-in centre. Part of the original crew, I guess, that kind of kicked things off when it was in a different situation. It was downstairs at the time. I'm looking forward to answering a few more questions.
Can you tell us a little bit about growing up in the Abba Valley in the 80s and 90s, please?
Going to make me go first this time, Ian?
I am.
All right, okay. Things were quite a bit different growing up in the 80s and 90s. There was a lot more activity, as you can imagine, and this is probably a story that you're going to hear from a lot of people if you interviewed and asked a similar question to this. Life was a more outdoorsy, more active, more kind of spending time with your friends, less social media. So the Abba Valley was quite a close-knit community, especially you're kind of growing up in and around St. Genneth. Everyone knew who everyone was. We all had kind of routines and things that we did. We did a lot of camping. We did a lot of outdoor activities. Went on our bikes, you know. So and it was quite a nice community to grow up in. I think it's changed a little bit now, in my opinion. But I definitely feel when I look back on my childhood, I do look back on it fondly.
Yeah, I think I'd have to agree with Mike on everything he said there. It was a really nice time to grow up within the valley. Again, lots of outdoor things to do. Mobile phones weren't invented when we were kids back then, so you weren't sat on your phone all day or on an Xbox all day. Like Mike said, it was always outdoors, camping, biking, meeting up with friends in the park. Yeah, really nice time, like I said. I agree with Mike, it was happy times.
The one thing I'll never get, though, I never quite understand how we managed to kind of organise everything. I mean, you know, these days, you know, you message on social media or you'll kind of arrange things and then arrange again and then say, I'm here, you know, where are you, type of thing. But when we were kids, we'd pretty much plan everything on the school bus on the way home. What are we doing tonight? And everything just seemed to work. And looking back on that, I still don't quite understand how it worked so well. You know, we still managed to organise things, do things, meet up, you know, and it seemed to work flawlessly. We always knew what everyone else was, even though we didn't have a tracker on them or an ability to kind of reach out to them. But now it feels like we're so dependent on technology that we couldn't function in that way.
No, I agree with you there. You know, we didn't have phones where you could put an alarm on it and say be somewhere at 5:30, but you could guarantee if someone on the school bus said we'll meet you at this point at this time, they'd be there bang on time without having an alarm to tell them where to be.
It's a weird one, but yeah, I think just from my perspective, just to kind of wrap it up, we had groups of people that we click with. You know, you do different things with different groups of people, but I think the key thing in the Abba Valley around the 80s and 90s was the fact that everybody knew everybody else. Everybody knew everybody else's parents as well, you know. So there was almost like a kind of an implied discipline, if that makes sense. If you'd wronged somebody, you knew it was coming back because everybody knew where it was. So everyone kind of stayed in line. But for that, it made you feel safe. It give you a sense of community. It give you a set. You know, you knew because you knew everybody. I think our parents are more comfortable with us going out, because you know someone somewhere would know who you were, and if you were going into trouble, you could just kind of turn to them. There was less traffic then, of course. So you know, I think I recall when I was younger, I think there was kind of two cars in my street, and that was pretty much it. Obviously, it got a little bit more when I got a bit older, but playing football in the street and doing things like that was, you know, nobody had a problem with that because you weren't, you know, bashing against people's cars and things like that. But we do things. We go for walks. We go up the mountain. We build dens. We go over the park. It was quite an active life. And obviously it was pre-internet as well. Well, not quite. When we went into the 90s, we had something that would resemble the internet, but not quite as it is today. But I think, yeah, in general, the Abba Valley was a good place. If I was to go back, and I wouldn't change much with regards to my upbringing. Quite happy with how it happened.
What did you think about CIDIC when it was first formed?
Right, well, when CIDIC was first formed, it was formed out of necessity. We were a bunch of kids. We hang around, and just like even now, you see a group of kids hanging around anyway, and some people get nervous. They phone the police. They think we're up to no good. When we're not, we're just hanging around and trying to have, you know, okay, we might be a bit loud, but we're not trying to cause any trouble or, you know, cause anybody some stress. So quite early on, we'd hang around in big groups, as I mentioned earlier, and we'd get moved on occasionally. The police knew who we were. We weren't trouble, but they would move us around, and then eventually we'd hang around in places like the park or a place we used to call the tunnel, which was just basically off the beaten track, so we could have some space without people, you kind of, you know, accusing us or thinking that we were doing anything untoward. And then we got given a room in the community centre. So, yeah, yeah, go on.
That's pretty much where it started, isn't it? The room downstairs, as it is. Everyone called it.
Yeah, so, when it was raining, there's something called the Annex now in the St. Genevieve Drop-In Centre, and it's had a revamp since we were using it. But there was a small room in there, and it was literally a room with a heater. That was it. And we were given a key. We were trusted with a key by Michelle. So it was one of the founders, or the founder for the drop-in centre, mostly because she was fed up with us hanging around in her house, if I'm honest.
So back then, Michelle had the house was actually a shop, so we would congregate in the shop, because the shop had closed, so it was just a big room, if you like, so we all just congregated in the front of the house. And she got pretty fed up after a little while, and that's how the drop-in centre came about, really, was what can we do to give these kids somewhere to go?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that room, we made it our own. We graffitied the walls, and no one had a problem with that. We had a heater, so it was dry and warm when we needed to be, and we had some music down there. And then we kind of outgrew that a little bit, but we'd proven that we could be trusted, and we'd proven that, you know, we needed somewhere because it was popular. People went there. In fact, it was too small to accommodate everybody at once, so we actually kind of naturally made some sort of rota. You know, we would go, some would go down there one night, some would go the other night. We would, you know, basically we gravitated towards not overfilling it because it just would have been unpleasant. So after that, then we got the hall downstairs, and again that was a similar thing. This, you know, I was a member at this point, so when the hall was downstairs, I was a member of the drop-in center. But they had like a little kitchen facility, and they had some games, you know, equipment, and we had a storage room at the back that we were allowed to decorate and paint the walls. I think Steve did quite a lot of that painting there. He was one of our friends. In fact, he was involved in the drop-in centre as well shortly after that, but he was quite creative and did all artwork on the wall there. Just again, allowed us a sense of ownership, a sense of belonging. And then I think from there we had some funding, Community's First funding, which allowed us then to kind of expand into what was the old caretaker's house. It's still the address for the drop-in centre now. And we had tons of funding, which allowed us to kind of move into there. And that was pretty much the time when that funding came. I think where me and you and a few others, Gav, became employees.
Yeah. It was, so I started off in February 1997 as a volunteer, as we all were back then.
Yep.
And we were here for around about 3-4 years before major funding came. And I think when we had the big lottery fund that allowed members to be paid. And at that point, I think, is when Dave came along and sort of... We kind of, at that point, started sort of growing too big too fast, if you like, for want of a better phrase. And didn't have the staff to cope with the numbers that we were getting in at that time.
We had some interesting nights, didn't we?
On average, I would have said it between 50 and 60 young people a night. And some of those young people were not always...
challenging.
Compliant with the rules, yeah. So yeah, we had a lot of challenging times.
I think it was new, wasn't it?
It was something that was new, something that everyone wanted to be a part of, I think, at that point.
When we first started with the drop-in centre, you know, we were some of us were troublesome, you know, and a little bit mischievous, and I think we had, you know, when we became kind of volunteers and we actually worked at the drop-in centre, because we were of similar age, maybe just a little bit older, I think we got more respect than we would have if we were a lot older. You know, it was kind of, and again, as go back to what we were saying, what it was like growing up in the Arbor Valley, we pretty much knew everybody that came in, and we knew their brothers and sisters and their parents. So if someone stepped out of line, most of the time you could bring them back into line by just, you know, kind of reminding them that it's not like school. You know, we can have those kind of conversations with the parents. And then initially, as Gavin said, it was difficult because there wasn't a sense of ownership early on. You know, basically you've got this new facility, they've got all these new computers in them, we had kind of games consoles, we had TVs, you know, it was all fresh. But, you know, with all the new members coming in, they hadn't become their drop-in centre at that point. It was just a new centre, a new facility. So it took a little while for them to get to the point where they were proud of the drop-in centre. They were bringing their own friends here, and then they would actually defend it if we had any problems or trouble from new people. Very rarely did the staff have to step in. They'd almost kind of self-govern, you know. It was that type of... And in fact, going back to what Gavin said earlier, when, you know, when we were thin on the ground with staff because it was so popular early on, we almost depended on the support from the older members to keep everyone else in line, because we couldn't have stayed open otherwise.
No, definitely not.
So then we, you know, there was a part of that we had the snooker hall as well, which was you know, in another part of the community centre, which allowed us to provide that service to the young people, but it spread us even thinner. And like Gavin said, you know, we were almost you know, kind of victims of our own success, in a sense that we had so much to offer. And don't get me started on the summer schemes. Some of the summer schemes were amazing. You know, the things that we did back then were, as a kid growing up, I didn't see anything like that. We had summer schemes, you know, which were put on down the rugby club, and they would, you know, you would play, you'd throw some beanbags in the rugby field, or you'd go down and, you know, you'd do a bit of skipping, or, you know, it was literally kind of budget stuff. And if you were really, if they had a proper budget, you might plant some plants and get to bring them home. Yeah. But the drop-in centre kind of took it to another level. It was really good. So, you know, fast forward to where we are now. I've moved on, obviously, from the drop-in centre. I was here for 9 years, and Gavin's still involved in some capacity now.
So, yeah, I was here for 20 years, and then I left because I had a young family, so I left in 2017 after 20 years. And then 2 years ago, I got a phone call out of the blue asking if I would like to come back and be involved again, which I jumped at the chance, really, you know. I kind of wanted to know, being away for that 5 years, how much it had changed within that 5 years. And it changed, it had changed quite a bit. I guess it was more that the young people were a lot different this time around than what we had previously. And there was less of them.
Yeah, I guess COVID has impacted as it would with everything.
Yeah, COVID impacted very bigly on that, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, I think fast forward to now, I will say the drop-in centre sponsored me quite a lot through my career. So while I was here, I managed to get involved in IT because, you know, that was part of some of the funding that we'd had, and that was one of the part of my role when I was here. And that's allowed me to kind of find a career in IT and move on to them sorts of things. And I still kind of do a little bit of consultancy work for the drop-in centre now and again. I get pulled in when things go pop. But in general, things are looking good. And I believe, you know, there's some new equipment that's just come in as well, which the young people are going to really, really get to use and get the most out of.
What do you think about the work Siddiq has done?
So, from the beginning, really, when we got the big lottery grant to do the renovations and turn it from a house into a youth centre as such, it's come a long way since then. There's been a lot of changes and a lot of different things that the youth centre have done. Going back a number of years ago, we entered into a partnership with St. Kenneth School, where we run an alternative provision for young people who were at risk of becoming NEETs, which children who would likely end up not in employment, education, or in any form of training, where we give them sort of your basic English and maths lessons, plus one of our senior youth workers at the time, he would do sort of carpentry lessons or metalwork, if you like, those kind of lessons, more practical things. The aim, getting these young people back into a school environment, but for some of them, school wasn't actually the best place for them at that time.
Yeah, and I think it was quite successful. You know, we had quite a number of them kind of achieving GCSEs or kind of equivalent qualifications. And you could see the difference between when they first came and kind of confidence levels, and they built a rapport with the staff that you wouldn't typically build with a teacher. And it allowed them to be more relaxed and be themselves, and they didn't get punished for being themselves. So I think it catered for more of that variety. And then I was involved in things like more serious, but different types of activities like homelessness and child protection. That was difficult, so that put me in positions where I was working with young people, I were either at risk of homelessness or in vulnerable positions and having to kind of deal with that. And that was a bit of an eye-opener for me, because like I mentioned, my childhood camp growing up in the Abba Valley was that it was a safe place, it was a safe community. And then just like any community, you suddenly realize that there are darker aspects that do need to be addressed, and they do need a service for that. So we got involved in that as well. We got involved with the Abba Valley Community Partnership and what was called the Abba Valley Action Plan. So that allowed us to have an influence on, what money got spent in the area. It even allowed us to design the skate park, which is currently, which has been put in as well. So we did consultation with the schools and things like that with the skate park. So there's always been, Siddiq's always put itself in a position where it can, kind of collaborate with and get more out of community initiatives, make sure that the young people are heard, make sure that their perspective is kind of included. And it's also, you get more out of it when you collaborate. So you can help each other out. You get more involvement, you get far more satisfaction and ownership with things when they get implemented as well. So yeah, I think just being involved in all them different things, and kind of as we mentioned, the great summer schemes that we did. We did some fantastic summer schemes, trips to Oakwood, quad biking, archery, bomb disposal, not real bombs, but still gorge walking. There was tons and tons and tons of different activities which allow the young people to, kind of gain new skills, gain confidence, and work collaboratively. So, kind of build that team building stuff, not only just between themselves, between the trust between them and the staff as well.
Going on to the team building stuff and going back to the summer scheme, talking about working collaboratively, we worked with Hopkins Farm. So back in the old days when we would have the Friday of the summer scheme, nowadays where they go either ice skating or Oakwood Park, back then we would spend a whole day on Hopkins Farm doing a lot of different team building activities, and then there would be a barbecue at the end of it and a karaoke that was normally supplied by Cookie, one of our other youth workers.
Yeah, that's right. That just reminds me, I know it's unrelated to this, but it reminds me when I used to run the discos downstairs. So it kind of, I know I've completely gone off on a tangent here, but it adds justification, I guess, to why the drop-in centre is required. So we had nothing as kids. And there was a guy that used to live in my my parents' street, and he had a bunch of disco equipment, and the YMCA in Arbitrator had a bunch of disco equipment, and the community centre did, and they all kind of clubbed together and gave it to me, basically, and we were able to rent the downstairs hall for, I can't remember how much it was, it was trivial, the amount of money, and we used to have discos, and the only caveat was no alcohol, which made sense, because we were 15, 16 years old, but it was, you know, it was really good. It brought everyone together. We had fun, and it just showed that if you put the right services in, that it's almost like the Field of Dreams, right? If you build it, they'll come. That was kind of, it showed that that was possible. It showed that if you provide a service that is actually wanted and needed, that it'll work. And Civic's a testament to that.
Are there any major changes that stand out to you about Civic from when you were young, when it first started out, and now?
Okay, yeah, I can take this one. Yeah, loads. I think the key thing, you know, kind of, as we've said throughout this interview process, is that Civic was born out of a need. It wasn't something that was kind of imposed. You know, there's sometimes a lot of initiatives, you know, in the kind of the youth space where someone in government or someone in public service thinks that this would be a good idea and therefore we'll create it and hopefully it's successful. Civic was born out of a requirement. It was proven, you know, there was a demand for the services that it offered. And it very quickly took off. You know, Civic's been, it's been compared, you know, or been the you know, kind of held high as being best practice for a lot of things in the way in which it provides services to young people, and the way in which it's inclusive. One of the things that we kind of touched on earlier in the interview was when Dave started, just to show how kind of inclusive the whole process was, I was actually involved in reading the CVs. I shortlisted Dave for the job. So, you know, that just shows the level of inclusion that the young people had. We actually had a copy of the CVs of the people who were candidates for running the place, and we basically shortlisted them and picked the, you know, the candidates. So, and that kind of carried on right the way through. I think, you know, with the youth partnership, with the youth committee, they're always very, very conscious of making sure that the decisions, the right decisions, are made for the right reasons. It was nice to see Civic grow when it first took off. It really grew. I think at, what was it at the pinnacle, Gav? It was like, what, 17 employees or something? It was big, right?
Yeah, at one point it was the...
Okay, yeah, it was, okay, yeah, maybe it was... slightly less than that, but I think the key thing here was that people and funders saw that it was a good thing and they were willing to invest in it. And we had lots and lots of money for lots of different things. And there were some very talented people here. And we were doing, like you said, you know, lots of hands-on workshops, even pottery. We were doing computer workshops. We were doing web building workshops. We would, you know, there was anything that there seemed to be a need for. And that was the key thing. The need was identified by the young people. And then, you know, efforts were made to get funding, secure funding to deliver it. It was a shame to see Civic go through a bit of a lull, you know, because after that big top bit, you know, when it had a ton of employees and a load of volunteers, and that's probably where I'm getting the idea of that many people, because, you know, they were paid employees, but there were a huge number of volunteers as well. And then, you know, funding crisis hit. It didn't just hit Civic, it hit the entire, you know, kind of youth kind of provision across the entire country. You know, the funding was moved to different places, and the thing that made it really difficult was that funders, even if they wanted to renew funding, always wanted more for the same money. So every year you had to try and deliver something extra, even though what you were delivering was kind of revered as being really sort of good.
Like having to jump that extra hurdle every time, wasn't it? You know.
Yeah.
You've jumped the hurdle, you've got what you wanted.
You've proven it works. You've
proven it works. But then there would always be someone putting another hurdle in front of you. Yeah, going, yeah. Well, you've got there now. Wait, how do you get it to that next level?
So you'd be like, I'm working with 150 young people. And they'd be like, oh, great, next year you can do 160. And it's like, well, 150 is not enough, you know. So you know, Civic did go in a little bit of a, you know, a downhill then as a result of that. Not in the services it was offering, but its ability to deliver, consistently deliver. You know, when we were involved early on, Gav, you know, Civic was open every day of the week. We then closed on a Friday because we very quickly realised that Friday is not a good day to open the service because of the older generation coming over a little bit intoxicated and kind of causing disruptive behaviour. So,
yeah.
You know, I guess what I'm saying is it didn't close because of funding, it closed because it was the right thing to do. And that's always been the kind of the ethos with the drop-in centre, is the fact that, you know, even if it's a difficult choice, that's the way that we try to do things, or the way that things get tried to get done.
I think you said it just before, didn't you? Is the right decision at the right time.
Yeah, and it's about being able to be adaptive, changing things, doing things in a different way. Just because it's worked before doesn't mean it works now. And that is part of why there's so much involvement with other, you know, other organisations, because you can adapt then. If there's suddenly something new that needs to happen, if you don't have the capacity and you don't have the funding, you've got a good relationship with a company that does, you can bring them in. And that's how CIDIC's managed to survive that lull, I think, you know, is they went from trying to do everything themselves to realising that, you know, or not realising, but being forced through funding restrictions that they can't. So now they need to cooperate and coordinate and bring in other companies, and they do the same thing. There's goals that other organisations need that they lean towards CIDIC on, and CIDIC fulfils their needs as well. So it's a mutual kind of relationship. I think I'd like to kind of move on a little bit and just mention something about just the changes in the Abba Valley as well. For me, it feels like the Abba Valley's lost a little bit of its community spirit. It's not. I think it's a modern thing, right? So, you know, you've got commuters now. Whereas we had the main employer, which was the sawmill, nearly everybody worked in the sawmill, or a lot of people did.
Yeah.
So people lived, worked, drank, socialised, everything in the Abba Valley. I think we've got two pubs now, maybe three.
I think it's just one.
One in St. Genis.
One pub in St. Genis.
But we've got the Windsor and the Abba.
Windsor is closed.
Oh, no, sorry, we've got the Abba. And yeah, so, we've got two pubs now where we used to have like three or four, maybe five, I don't know. But I think the key thing there is that, you know, the whole social aspect is changing, which makes me, you know, even more kind of confident that CIDIC's the right, you know, is in the right place to provide that gap. You know, to provide that social aspect, because there are less places now in the Abba Valley for that to happen. People, like you say, people tend to commute out now, or they tend to keep themselves to themselves because of there's less kind of social areas or social, you know, kind of businesses that they can kind of do that thing on. But yeah, I think, you know, in general, I think CIDIC's gone from strength to strength. It's done really good things with the resources that it's got. And I'm enthused to see what it's got for the future.
I think one of the changes for me is, obviously, it's a change, but it hasn't changed because some staff are different, but then a lot of the staff are still those staff who were originally here or started here at the same time as Dave.
You've got that continuity.
So there's the continuity and that consistency, and the young people know who's going to be there. And for me, a lot of the time is that if that young person knows the situation they're going into and the people they're going in, and they've got a good relationship with those people, then they feel safer, they feel more confident, and they're more comfortable in that surrounding. I moved out of the area 20 years ago. My dad still lives in the area, so I come to visit quite often. And I obviously come back to work one night a week here as well. And the change I've noticed is that, I was talking to Laurie earlier on, the streets seem quieter, and it's not just quieter with young people, but it's quieter with a population in general. It doesn't seem that many people on the streets, and I think that harks back to what Mike said about those areas where you could socialise and where you could go to meet people. They're just not there anymore.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, the parks have been taken away, right? I mean, you know, we used to go over and play in the park. You know, they've physically been moved. I think the one up by Stanley Street's gone. The one over by Kingsley Place is gone. The one we call the Bottom Park, the one that's further down the valley, that's still there. But that is, I'd say, much younger orientated, right? So Oh, yeah, there's one up at the Fours as well. Yeah, but I think the key thing is that even the things in the park are different, and I realise it's health and safety. But you know, you don't have swings anymore. You don't have roundabouts where you can kind of spin people to the point where they fly off. And I realise that is why you don't have them. But it just all the things that we used to have as kids that were which was fun. They've almost taken that away to de-risk injury and worry about kind of being sued for someone picking up an injury. Whereas as a kid, it was almost normal for one of us to be walking around with a cast on.
I think I can agree with that. I was quite often in a cast as a kid, yeah. So if it wasn't my arm, it was my leg, yeah. And that was normally either through playing rugby or riding a bike, So again, we go back to those outdoor sports, those outdoor activities rather than being sat on a phone or a computer these days, It's, I think that's the biggest change anywhere, isn't it, is that...
It is, and I think as a kid, if I was in that position, if you told me when I was a kid that that's what life was going to be like, I'm not sure I would have accepted it as easy as you would now. Just the idea of waking up in the morning and not going for not going up the mountain or not going out. And so we were lucky enough that we had a friend who lives or his family owned the farm, and we were able to spend quite a bit of time on there and safely go camping and kind of just get involved in the outdoor life. I think that really did make a difference, and it kind of allowed us to kind of realize, put things in perspective, I guess, of a childhood where you can, and I kind of brushed on it earlier, we went up there, we built dens, we went fishing, we did walks, there was so much that we could do in a fairly safe environment. And then the funny thing was is that when we did camp up there was this thing called raiding that was a thing. So if you went camping, the older ones, they'd see a campfire at night, and they would come and scare you in the night. But because we knew the farm and we knew it really well, we'd always camp in places which was in the middle of a bog, but there was a dry bit in the middle of the bog. So we would purposely light the fire and just sit and wait for people to come and raid us, and then help pull them out of the bog at the end. So they were just things, they're just really cool memories that you wouldn't expect young people to experience today. So that was a key part of growing up here, I think.
Are there any traditions that started when you were growing up here that continue on today?
Yeah. There's a couple of traditions that we did. They're not so much today, I think. What I mean by that is that we had quite a lot of celebrations. There was a good community spirit growing up. So we had things like Jubilee, street parties. We had
the VE Day.
Yeah, we closed. I mean, there was less traffic then, but they would close the roads. It would be a table right way down the middle. Everybody would be out. We'd have discos, we'd have street performers, magicians. We even had a bouncy castle one year. It was full on, and everybody, and I do remember, I think it was, we had a disco one year that we couldn't find a way of powering it, so they ended up, I had asked my mum politely, and we ended up an extension lead going from her house running the disco. So everybody chipped in, and it was, it was really, really, again, the community spirit was fantastic. One of the things we did, I guess it still goes on today, but to a lesser extent, is bonfires. We were heavily involved in, it was a thing, you prepared. It wasn't something that just...
No, it was one of those ones where you, leading up to it, maybe weeks leading up to it.
Yeah, it was planned.
Where you'd go around collecting things for it, storing it somewhere.
People would leave stuff outside if you knew bonfire night was coming. So any time from kind of mid-October, you'd just leave anything flammable outside your house and it'd be gone the same day. It'd be stored, the bonfires would be built. And there was a lot of competition, right? There were three bonfires in the valley, four actually. So we had the four terraces, we had...
Stanley Street,
Brynhyfryd, yeah, and then the West End. There was one that was down by the Windsor, but I guess it depends whether you want to class that as St. Genis, but that's definitely Aber Valley. In fact, that reminds me when we used to have the shows that turned up on the Windsor before the memorial went there. Do you remember that?
Yes.
As a kid, there used to be a fairground.
The Twisters and the Dodgem cars.
I had my fair share of goldfish from that winning, you know, kind of dart games and different things and Dodgems. Anyway,
The fish never lasted long, though.
No, they didn't. But the reason I brought that up is that was the site of the bonfire for the Windsor when they weren't there. So it's now being converted into the Memorial Garden. But there was a lot of competition. You'd have different groups of people raiding other bonfires. They'd steal bits in the night covertly to try and, you know, kind of bolster their supply. And it just reminds me of a time where, you know, we started another bonfire up by what was called the Black Bridge. And one year, just to try and save from all that hassle, I put an advert out in Johnny Gavana's window to invite people to just bring anything that they wanted to get rid of on the day. And we had a conveyor belt going. We had cars literally lined up. They pull up, we'd empty it, we'd build the bonfire, we built it there and then, and we had a fantastic bonfire that year. So it just... We just got fed up of the politics or the bonfire wars. So we just started a new one. I don't think there's that many bonfires now. I think it's only pretty much two now. Actually, the West End. Do the West End still have one?
They don't have one anymore.
Just Brynhyfryd then, is it?
Just Brynhyfryd, I think, still have one occasionally.
Yeah. And the rugby club, of course. That was quite the centre. You know, we had kind of race nights and we had fireworks displays down the rugby club. That was, you know, a lot of things growing up in the valley. But I think, you know, just to kind of come back to the question, I think there was a lot of traditions in the community where we grew up. You know, there was a lot. Whenever there was an opportunity to pull everybody together, we'd do it. And like I said, even we'd run our own parties if there wasn't much going on, you know, we'd take our own initiative. And the drop-in centre kind of played into that then. It was a congregation point, you know, people came here, even if they're going somewhere else, they came to the drop-in centre to meet up initially, before they moved on to somewhere else. But I think, you know, some of them traditions still exist, but not as strong, I don't think.
I'd have to agree with you there, and obviously Gwyn Avenue, which is the street that the drop-in centre is on, could never hold their own street party because it was the main street through the village.
Right. Yeah.
So if I remember rightly, Gwyn Avenue would quite often bolster onto the end of Kingsley Place and they'd merge the two streets and have a bigger party all streets had parties. Not all streets had parties, because I think in the West End, I think Grove Terrace, they quite often merged with the Park Terrace and they had a street party there. Again, some of those are main streets through the valley, so you couldn't really close off the streets.
But they were spread out throughout the valley.
There was always great fun, I think.
And it was, again, we talk about community spirit, you know, there was no, you could move between them if you wanted to. Typically, the residents were asked to chip in so that we could finance and fund things, so the food and the drink and things like that. But I think in general it was a good place to grow up.
I think in terms of the people who lived in the streets back then, they kind of, I don't know, people in the streets, they sort of formed their own committees, if you like, and they each member of the street had a different role to play. Like one person in the street would be tasked with organising the drinks, one would be tasked with organising food, you know, and music.
Yeah, you're right.
And like, you know,
yeah.
It was kind of a traditional kind of committee setup where each person took it upon themselves to do an individual role to create that party in the first place. You know?
Yeah, it kind of goes back to what we said earlier. You know, people were just self-organising back then. There wasn't this kind of obsession with having a plan for everything. And everything happened to be kind of perfect. It just happened, and whatever needed to be done, people done. And like you said, people gravitated towards their strengths. And if you wanted something to happen, it just kind of happened. Whereas today, I think if you tried to pick a street and organise a street party, you know, half the people in some of the streets wouldn't know each other. Other people would be reluctant to get involved, and. Certainly back then there was far more trust. We kind of talked about this off mic, but you know, we can put it on the recording as well, is that, you know, it was very normal to not lock your front door when we were kids. You know, if you're going to visit someone, you just walked in. If you want to show some respect, you knocked the door as you walked in, but you just walked in. Now, you know, we've got security in place. Everyone's got cameras on their doors. You know, there's far more kind of, there's far more concern for security now than there was back then. But I guess that's what I'm trying to say, is that's part of why things don't happen these days, I guess. You know, if you have a street and everyone's got their door open and everyone's going in and out their houses, you have to trust everyone, you have to know everyone. And that's not necessarily the case, at least not everywhere now, which is quite sad, to be honest.
That was all really interesting to hear. Thank you for coming in and talking to me.